It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we hear from a Wisconsin documentary filmmaker who has turned his lens to the issue of solitary confinement in prisons.
First, in Paul Ryan's first address to the U.S. House of Representatives after having been elected Speaker, he called for a new spirit of cooperation and commitment to working together on behalf of the American people.
The House is broken. We're not solving problems. We're adding to them. And I am not interested in laying blame. We are not settling scores. We are wiping the slate clean.
That message resonated with the Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, Robin Voss, who joins us now to talk about what changes he plans to make in the Wisconsin legislature. Speaker Voss, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me up.
So what was it about Speaker Ryan's speech that really hit home for you?
Well, it's interesting because Mark Pocan and I have been friends ever since I was elected to the legislature. And even during Act 10, he and I put out a statement of civility to say that we can disagree and even do so passionately, but it should never become personal. We should also remember the great honor that we've been given to serve in an elected position. I feel pretty good in the last session we did that. I mean, we had a pretty good series of bipartisan legislation. In fact, 95% of all of the bills that were passed in the Wisconsin State Assembly were bipartisan. So I think that's the model that we really need to utilize. And by and large, that's still been true. But over the course of the past several weeks, the debates that we've been under have just been so much more personal than they should have been. Unfortunately, even I succumb to that on occasion. So I just wanted to make a commitment to the body that my job as Speaker is to rise above that. And I asked all the other members, Republicans and Democrats, to join me in saying that we should remember the honor that we're given and not fall into the hyperbole and all of the name-calling that sometimes people associate with politicians.
As you just referenced in your speech to the Assembly this Tuesday, you said, quote, things in the Assembly have been too emotional, too personal in recent weeks. I myself am guilty of this. That's the end of the quote. Politicians are not always known for admitting guilt. Why do you think it was necessary to shoulder some of that responsibility yourself?
Well, I think the most important thing, if we're going to change the attitude and the tone, is to accept that all of us are responsible for the world that we live in. You know, it's very easy to point fingers, but the reality is you have to start by looking at yourself and saying, how can I do better before you ask people around you to join you? So that's why I wanted to look and say that I'm proud, by and large, of all the things that we're doing, but we certainly could be more collaborative. We could reach out more. Last session we signed a memorandum of understanding with the Democrats to change the way that we operate. And even during the debate, the Democrats were kind enough to acknowledge that the chamber is better than it has been. But just because it's better doesn't mean it's exactly where it should be. So that's why I wanted to say I'm definitely extending my hand to people in the opposition party. And I hope that they would take it in the good spirit that I'm offering it and find ways that we can continue to work together.
We're speaking with Robin Voss, who is Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly. He represents the 63rd District in southeastern Wisconsin. And we're talking about efforts to bring more civility back to the Wisconsin legislature. Now, Speaker Voss, in Wisconsin, the Republican Party has controlled both the Assembly and the Senate, as well as the governor's office, since 2011. That has left the Democrats in a minority position, really as much a minority position as possible. Speaker Ryan talked about being in the majority and working across the aisle.
If you know the issue, you should write the bill. Let's open up the process. Let people participate. And they might change their mind. A neglected minority will gum up the works. A respected minority will work in good faith.
So, Speaker Voss, obviously part of being in the majority is having power and having control. How much do you think your fellow Republican legislators are going to be willing to share some of that with the Democrats to bring them into the fold?
Well, and I think that's the exact point that we're trying to raise, is that, you know, we're not necessarily saying that we're going to have a wholesale change in what positions that we adopt, because I do agree that Republicans are in control, and of course, we want to work together in ways that are able. So rather than focusing on the things that divide us, my hope is that we can focus on things that bring us together. Last session, I formed a speaker's task force on mental health. It was Republicans and Democrats working together. It passed over a dozen pieces of legislation, all bipartisan, all focusing on saying, what can we do to help people who have mental health issues? I think there are topics like that. Just this last week, I put a bill on the calendar from one of my Democratic colleagues that dealt with veterans issues. So I think there's an awful lot of things where we really do have that common ground. In the memorandum of understanding that I mentioned earlier, one of the requests that we had was that if Democrats want to offer amendments to Republican bills that are on the floor, I gave my word that we would consider them, but that they had to give them to us, you know, a couple hours so that we could actually research them and find out what the effects were before we were on the floor. That happened in the beginning, but then as of late, Democrats have really kept the amendments and literally offered them only minutes before we go to the floor, just assuming we're always going to vote no. So my hope is that we can use that good faith to say, if you have a good idea, I don't care what party it's from, but you have to give me an opportunity to do some research. You know, at the same time, many times Democrats criticize us for only having a couple weeks after a bill is introduced to get it to the floor for a vote. I guess I would ask the same thing in return to say, if you want us to consider your amendments to our bills or your bills in general, they have to spend more than, you know, 5 minutes on the floor for us to understand what they're doing. So I hope it's just a good faith effort on both sides to listen, to learn, and to take the best whoever has a chance to offer it.
Have you gotten any response to your call for more civility from your Democratic colleagues?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty good overall. I've had several of them come up to me and say, you know, you're right. We need to get back to the way that things have been in the past. I sat down with the Democratic leadership, and we're working for additional ways to continue to collaborate. And one thing, and it doesn't mean that we're not going to be passionate and that we won't have some disagreement, but I guess I would rather focus on the things that we agree to keep Wisconsin moving forward as opposed to just consistently going back to the themes that might sound like typical politicians, but they don't make us proud.
Certainly your position as Speaker gives you a fairly weighty position to speak from about bringing more civility in, but do you anticipate pushback from any of your own party members? And if you get it, how will you address that?
No, I really haven't had that. I talked about it in our caucus, so that I want to make sure. And the one thing that I've learned is, regardless of political party, almost every single person in the legislature has a good heart. I think they want to do right. We just have different paths to get there. And I think regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you enjoy public policy debates. So I don't think any of my own colleagues would look and say that there's something wrong with trying to include the other side, because I'm not asking them to change what they believe or to sacrifice their principles, just simply to take a little bit of extra time to listen to the other side and look for the best ideas that they have, rather than assuming everything that they offer is something you can't support.
Certainly the Assembly is a significant part of Wisconsin politics and government, but there's also the Senate. Do you see a similar commitment by the Senate leadership, and are you going to push for that in the other part of the House?
Well, I can't control that, I have to be honest, so of course I would hope for that, but I guess leading by example is the way that I have always tried to function. So I'm hopeful that if we're able to show that we can get along and do good things for the people in the Assembly, I have no doubt that our Senate colleagues will follow, because it's something Governor Walker's talked about often. He does want to bring people together. Of course, we've had tumultuous times, but rather than focusing on that, which was years ago, I think we should try to focus on the future, which all of us have a common interest in making the very best we possibly can be.
Speaker Voss, what concrete steps in this direction should we be watching for in the coming months?
Well, I hope that you're going to see, when we put out Assembly calendars, starting especially in the spring, my goal is to have bills every single time we're on the floor from not just Republicans, but also from Democrats. And I'm hoping that we're going to be able to have people focus on those topics, that once again, common ground is easier to find, to create a little bit of momentum going into the spring calendar so that we can show, regardless of your political party, your views are represented, and hopefully people can take that in their own lives to say, you know, maybe I'll at least listen to the other side as opposed to whatever they say is negative or nasty or something you could never support, when in reality, most of America wants us to work together, and I just have to do my very best to try to make it happen in the world that I can live in.
Speaker Voss, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Robin Voss is the Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly. He represents the 63rd District in southeastern Wisconsin.
Go Big Read, the partnership between the Madison Public Library and University of Wisconsin-Madison, is centered around prison reform this year. As part of the planned events, the Downtown Library will be hosting a screening of a documentary on that subject by our next guest.
Tim Corson is a Madison television producer and educator who produced videos on the work of several groups working on the Reform Now movement. He joins us in our studio. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So you have an interesting story about how you got involved in the issue of prison reform in Wisconsin. Can you share that with us?
Well, many years ago, my family and I were the victims of an attempted burglary. And eventually the two young men who tried to get into our house were apprehended. And we learned about something called restorative justice. And so we had two face-to-face meetings, one with each of the young men. And it was a very positive experience, and it got me interested in restorative justice.
So a lot of people will say, you know, we're talking about prisons, we're talking about criminals, we're talking about people who have done something wrong, often with a victim involved. And, you know, there is a mentality often of, you know, kind of lock them up and throw away the key. Why should the average citizen be concerned about what goes on in prisons and trying to reform the system?
Well, when Brian Stevenson came and spoke at the university last week, he talked about changing the narrative that we have as a culture about crime and punishment. And I think that's what you just described there is really a big part of the narrative. And in the last 40 years, the whole idea of rehabilitation has kind of gone by the wayside. And because of that, we've had also another narrative of kind of punishment and retribution for crimes. And what has resulted is a huge increase in the prison population, roughly 500% increase over that period of time. And it's come to cost the state over $1 billion a year. I'm not familiar with the exact number. So on one level, we should care about it because of the huge cost. But otherwise, the cost to the community in terms of breaking up families and lost livelihood is a big factor, too. And that we should consider.
It also seems like the fact that many of those people who are incarcerated will eventually be going back to communities is also an incentive to make sure that they are coming out ready to reintegrate.
Yeah. And so right now we're investing in a system that is proven not to work very well. It 30% of people who come out of prison will return within the first 3 years. So that's a pretty bad ratio. And so in many ways, people are leaving prison worse off than when they came in. And so aside from whatever you think about criminals, we have invested in a system that is not serving the public interest. And I would also like to add, as a crime victim, I understand the trauma that crime victims have gone through, and the whole emphasis of restorative justice is to repair the harm, and that means taking care of victims, but also looking at the needs of the offender and what do they need to do to accept the responsibility for their actions and not commit crimes again in the future.
So there's incarceration, but then there is also the issue of solitary confinement and what that really means. Solitary confinement is used why and when and for how long?
Well, originally the whole idea of solitary confinement was something to get away from corporal punishment. And so instead of flogging people or doing all kinds of horrible things to them, this was seen as an alternative to that. And so in some ways it was looked at as a more humane response. But the early experiences with that, they found that it was really hard on the people who went through that. And so it's used now as a disciplinary measure. But what has happened is that it's gone completely out of control, and that it's used for minor things, and there's no real accountability in the prison system as far as when solitary confinement is used and also for how long. So we have people in our state right now who have been in solitary confinement for years and even decades. And this is isolation from all human contact for 23 or 24 hours a day. And so many of those people have mental illness, and this is a way that they are dealt with. It's just kind of shut off from the rest of the prison population. And so it's something that most people don't know is going on. And I think if they did, they would not accept that.
Tim Corson is a television producer and educator who produced videos on the work of several groups working on the Reform Now movement, dealing with solitary confinement and other prison issues. We are talking with him about his documentary and especially about this issue of solitary confinement. And I think for any of us who have not been incarcerated and have not been in solitary confinement, it's really hard to imagine what that experience is like. But there is an effort to help people at least get a glimpse into that by constructing a replica of a solitary confinement cell. What does that cell look like? Describe it for us.
Well, the cell is built on the specifications of a prison cell in Wisconsin. And so we try to make it as realistic as possible. And one of the things that Brian Stevenson talked about in his presentation at the university was that to solve this problem, we have to kind of move people into proximity, into closer proximity. And so since it's impossible for people really to go into a prison and see a solitary cell, we decided to build one so people could at least get a sense of what kind of places that people are locked in for sometimes many, many years.
And the dimensions are what by what?
I can't remember specifically, but it's a little bit wider than the average person's arm span.
So about 6.5 feet, I believe.
Yeah, and then maybe 15 feet long. And it just has a bed and a sink toilet combination and maybe a table.
And it's interesting because until I watched part of your documentary, when we hear solitary confinement or segregation, it almost sounds like kind of a monastic experience, like you're you know, in this cell, but I never thought about the dimension of sound. And and there's a very effective part of your documentary where the Reverend Kate Edwards, she's a chaplain in a Wisconsin prison, shows us the replica of a solitary confinement cell, but then also talks about that dimension of audio. Let's listen.
It really makes a difference when people can actually stand inside a cell, even spend an hour inside of it, and get a much better sense of what it would be like to spend weeks or months or years or even decades inside of a cell like this. It's very powerful. Underneath the bed, we have a small guitar amp, cable connected to it, and an iPod with an audio file of the sound from an actual segregation unit.
I have to say, just listening to that just sets all of my nerves on edge. I literally can't imagine what that would be like 24 hours a day.
Yes, and the person that was talking there has done as a chaplain within the prison system, and she told me that one of the people said to her that the only time it really gets quiet is for about 10 minutes after the food is served, because people are eating. And so it's a very, very stressful environment that damages people in a deep way.
So the Reform Now movement has what as its goal? Is it completely eliminating solitary confinement? Is it more monitoring? What would make this a better situation?
Well, solitary confinement is one of the four issues that we're concerned with. And definitely reforms, elimination would be great, but we want to be in a dialogue with the Department of Corrections. And There's also the issue of old law prisoners, of prisoners who were sentenced before the Truth in Sentencing, and they have much longer sentences. The judges gave them assuming that they would be paroled, and they're serving out their full terms. And then revocation and GPS monitoring. People can get revoked, their parole revoked for non-criminal offenses. And then also compassionate release for prisoners who are just about on their last legs and won't really cause any harm to society.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tim Corson, a Madison television producer and educator who has produced a number of videos about the groups working on the Reform Now movement.
His video and a Reform Now resource fair will take place at the Madison Public Library next Tuesday. The library will also have that replica of a solitary confinement cell on display starting this Saturday through November 12th. Yesterday's announcement of the closing of the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison caught pretty much everyone by surprise. The city and region will lose about 1,000 jobs and millions of dollars in economic activity. WPR reporter Parth Shaw covered yesterday's announcement. Parth, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, you were at this press conference yesterday. Set the scene. What was the mood like there?
It was interesting. There was Mayor Soglin led the news conference generally, and behind him were all the city council members. And he did most of the speaking. When he was asked by a reporter if he was frustrated about it, before he could respond, all the city council members kind of sighed, and they said, yes, we are frustrated about it. But he said that his response was a little bit different. He said that the city would continue some sort of relationship with Oscar Mayer in the future. The interesting thing about this is that Mayor Soglin got the heads up Tuesday evening. And he was told in person by an Oscar Mayer official that the factory would be closing. And he's basically the only person who really got an inside scoop about it. All the other employees, even the governor, didn't find out until Wednesday afternoon.
This was a surprise to just about everybody. And that wasn't much heads up even for the mayor.
Exactly.
But there is some time this is going to go on over the course of a year. So in that sense, it's not they're not closing tomorrow.
Exactly. The closing will happen over the next 12 to 24 months. About 250 employees will be relocated to Chicago. But really, this is not just about the employee loss. I mean, there's going to be substantial ripple effects on the community as a whole. Oscar Mayer is a huge donor to United Way of Dane County. They donated about $500,000. And in the future, I mean, they're not going to be able to make those kind of donations anymore. And we think about the other ripple effects to vendors, maybe people who are bringing packaging or who are providing cleaning supplies. Like, there's going to be major effects felt in the economy and the community here.
What did we hear from local and state leaders on a response to this to try to do something about that damage?
It's interesting. Pat Schramm, the executive director of the region's Workforce Development Board, said that if there is any time for this to happen, it's now. The economy is doing well. We're not in a recession. And she said that there's going to be a lot of active movement to get people relocated into new jobs. They're launching a rapid response plan to get in touch with employees, get in touch with Oscar Mayer, and try to get a plan ready so if people need additional training to get into new jobs, that can be provided for them.
Yeah, so nobody is saying, hey, this is good news, obviously, but that's an example of maybe a positive twist on it. This could have been worse in some ways.
Yeah, they're looking for the silver lining, definitely.
So any other concrete things that people are talking about for the workers coming out of these jobs, for the site itself, for that hole in the economy?
It's interesting. We'll find out what happens to that Oscar Mayer plant. It could be turned into condominiums. It could be maybe bought out by another company. That is still yet to be said. But the changes in Oscar Mayer in general are not just felt in Madison. There's 7 plant closings in general, if we include the one here in Wisconsin. That's both in the United States and in Canada. But Wisconsin has seen a trend of losing manufacturing jobs. According to the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, this area has lost about 100,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years.
All right. Well, you'll be following this story, and maybe we'll talk to you again as we hear more details. Parth, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Parth Shaw.
There have been a lot of efforts lately to turn the tide against bullying in the United States, in schools, and increasingly online. Our next guest says that in addition to confronting the behavior of bullying, we need to dig deeper into the root causes. He says one key factor behind bullying and many other acts of violence is shame.
Jonathan Fast joins us now. He's an associate professor of social work at Yeshiva University. His new book is Beyond Bullying, Breaking the Cycle of Shame, Bullying, and Violence. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Why is shame such a key part of the puzzle when it comes to bullying?
Well, it's been said, Richard Gilligan said that shame is at the root of all violent acts, and that it's a necessary but not sufficient cause for violence. And we can see the role that shame plays. We can see how it passes from the bully into the victim.
Let's look at both sides of that bullying equation. The bully and the bullied can be driven in different ways, you write, by shame. Spell that out for us.
Well, so typically the bully's father or mother or, you know, someone in the family, someone who has been there since he was little, has been shaming him in one way or another. And maybe his friends also have been shaming him or his playmates. And he is raised in a family where the problem-solving style is violent and aggressive. So he has this shame, and he has to manage it. He has to deal with it. And so he manages it by displacing it onto a child who will be a good victim. And by a good victim, I mean someone who's smaller and weaker and won't fight back. And there, you know, he has a sense of who this child will be, and he displaces the shame onto him and then beats him up, either emotionally or physically. So that's how it's transferred. It's a little bit like scapegoating, you know, like blaming.
Externalizing your own shame.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, you'll hear people will ask bullies, why did you pick on him? And he'd say, just because he's trouble, he's responsible for everything, even though it doesn't make any sense.
And you've been saying he, but you do write bullying happens for boys and girls, men and women, for that matter. Does it play out differently by gender, though?
In general, it does. In general, girls tend to bully what they call relational bullying. So they spread rumors and they isolate other girls, as opposed to boys use aggressive direct bullying, which is they just go over and insult them or hit them or whatever. And of course, there are a lot of exceptions to this. So internet bullying, which is one of the most vicious and destructive kinds of bullying, is all relational bullying because it is based on anonymous rumors about people.
And in your book, you use the concept of weaponized shame. What do you mean by weaponized shame?
Well, you know, there's useful shame, which is healthy shame, as it's sometimes called, that is used to educate someone. So, for example, if you're dealing with a toddler, let's say, and you're trying to teach them to eat properly, you're shaming them because you're saying, well, you can't sit at the grown-up table until you can eat without finger painting with your peas or whatever. So that's the kind of healthy shaming because it leads to better behavior. But it has to be carefully done or it becomes just a toxic shaming. And if it's done intentionally, as with the case of bullying, then I like to think of it as weaponized shame because it's being used as a weapon, and it's a very powerful weapon. It's very devastating to a person.
It's a weapon that excludes people from their place, the place they should be at in that society, in this case of maybe school kids.
Right. I think it's very useful to think of all people as existing in groups. Being in groups is one of the most important human urges. And shame is what you experience either when you feel that your membership in a group becomes tenuous or when you try to enter a group of higher status and you're rejected from it. So those are the two situations. And typically in a bullying situation, you know, like with 8-year-olds or 9-year-olds, the bully will accuse the other child of being immature or babyish. So he'll be saying, you know, you don't really belong in this group because you're a baby. And the victim will have just this, even if he has just a sliver of doubt about his own maturity, he'll think, well, maybe I am a baby. There's that possibility. And the shame, and that's when he starts to feel the shame, you know, or the bully can say, well, you're an idiot. You don't belong in school. You know, so his membership in the school community becomes tenuous. And again, the part of him is thinking, well, maybe he's right. Maybe I'm not smart enough to go to school.
Once upon a time, I think the consequences of bullying were not really thought of. People thought this is kids being kids. Maybe it'll build character in the long run. I think that conversation has changed. Can you talk about some of the impacts of this shame-driven bullying?
Well, the conversation, you know, bullying, I don't think anyone ever complained about bullying until relatively recently. I think it was thought to be something that toughens kids up for the world, for being adults. But during 1997, 98, and 99, there was a number of school shootings took place, climaxing in the Columbine shooting in April of 1999. And, of course, the one thing that they found that all these shootings had in common was that the perpetrators had been bullied. And that's actually what got me thinking about shame in terms of bullying and school shooting and acts of domestic terrorism. And, you know, that's sort of what brought me to writing the book.
We're talking to Jonathan Fast, author of the new book, Beyond Bullying, Breaking the Cycle of Shame, Bullying, and Violence.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. You can share your experiences of bullying. How did you deal with it? And our guest says feelings of shame are a big part of the motivation for the bully and the suffering of the bullied. Do you agree? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Jonathan Fast, author of Beyond Bullying, Breaking the Cycle of Shame, Bullying, and Violence.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Were you a bully or have you been bullied in your life? What our guest is saying ring a bell with you? How has your community or your school, maybe even your workplace, tried to deal with bullying, or has it at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Jonathan, I wanted to at least spend a little time on solutions. You talk about the idea of restorative justice as one avenue to work on issues of bullying.
Mm-hmm. Really, what we say in education is restorative practices, because we're not dealing so much with the justice as just creating a civil society in the schools. It's really, I think, impossible to do away with bullying, because there will always be people who are aggressive and angry and trying to manage a lot of shame inappropriately. But I think we can make schools much more civil, and we can help kids deal with their shame, and we can stop using retributive justice, like, putting kids on suspension and zero tolerance. That sort of thing really does not help anyone. One of the principles of restorative justice is putting together the victim and the perpetrator and letting them talk to each other. And that's not always a good idea in bullying situations, but if it is possible, you know, if it does seem safe for everyone, then it's really very useful for the victim to talk to the bully, and also members of the community, which in this case would be the school, and let the bully know how he's perceived by the others. And, you know, it may not make any difference the first time or the second time, but what people who investigate this have found is that if the bully hears it over and over, at some point he's convinced and his behavior changes, and that's really worth the effort.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Marcos on the line in Madison. Marcos, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just would like to know what the author thinks about the bullying that usually occur against foreigners, students in university level, for instance, from Asia, Latinos, etc. They usually, you know, it's a very silent kind of bullying, but there have been happens for quite some time. I teach in university level, and I have seen that a lot. And I think nobody much pay attention to this kind of the level of bullying that occurs in these academic university, you know, settings and so on.
Marcos, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Jonathan, you write about that not just in schools, but this sort of shame-based bullying playing out in society at large when it comes to, say, immigrant communities.
Yeah, I'm really glad he brought that up. What happens is, as a society where people experience a lot of shame, they also bully in groups, and other groups are scapegoated, and they're always the most vulnerable populations. So they tend to be minority races, homosexuals or people with different gender presentations, and immigrants. And it's terrible that a country like this that was built by immigrants and that gets its vitality out of immigrant populations should be giving them such terrible treatment right now. I mean, if you look at the things that are going on with Mexicans, for example, and African Americans who continue to be scapegoated and bullied despite all the civil rights legislation that's been going through in recent years. It's really appalling.
Marcos, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jonathan Fast, author of the new book, Beyond Bullying. We'll go back to our callers. We've got Shannon on the line in Franklin. Shannon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a little upset listening to your expert author. I have a child that was severely bullied to the point of having to be involuntarily committed to a psychiatric facility at the age of 6 years old. And what I'm hearing is that we're now taking the side of the bully, and we're looking at their social environment, their parenting, things like that. And it's really upsetting to me to hear this because there's nobody out there that, in my child's case, for instance, I was on the PTO. I was in the classroom. I was doing everything I could, but it kept happening and happening. And the schools are so overwhelmed. And that when you say that there's bullying and, you know, those type of campaigns don't work, they do work. She's in a great school now that there's zero tolerance. And I just feel like your expert is making excuses for these children.
Shannon, thanks a lot. I'm very sorry for your and your child's experience. Jonathan, are we putting too much maybe sympathy on the side of the bully in this situation?
Well, I'm really sorry about what's happened to Shannon. That's terrible. Nobody should have to experience that. I'm making a lot of generalizations here. I'm talking about huge groups of people and generalizing. But certainly in a situation like this, this is terrible. Really, a child of that age. And I guess the bully was just maybe a little older or maybe even the same age. But you know, when you generalize like this, and if you're going to change the way the bully behaves, you have to understand the bully, I think.
Thanks for that call, Shannon. And generalizing or going a little further, Jonathan, again, getting back to you mentioned earlier, domestic violence, maybe having similar causes to bullying, this sort of shame. You're ultimately not excusing, I don't think, as you write, people who commit an act of domestic violence. You're hoping that by understanding what led up to that over the years, maybe we can head that off and prevent it from happening in the first place.
Yes, I just hope that this kind of understanding and analysis doesn't get mistaken for sympathy or encouragement of violence against vulnerable populations.
Again, at the root of everything you write about is this idea of shame. And one of the things you say is there's not a lot of conversation about shame. There's surprisingly little academic research on the impacts of shame. Are we ashamed of bringing up this concept in the first place?
Absolutely. It seems to be a forbidden topic. You know, there used to be a joke that there were three forbidden topics, and they were sex, money, and religion. But, you know, in fact, we do talk about all those things frequently, but people never talk about shame. And I even have colleagues who are shame scholars who have been told by their department heads, you know, that if they continue in this particular line of research, it's not going to bode well for their academic careers.
Briefly, what's at stake if we don't start having this conversation?
Well, I think that what's happening in this country now is that the requirements of being an adult are becoming more and more difficult to meet. So there was an article recently about the middle class earning less than $30,000, 50% of the middle class, and that the chasm between the wealthy and the poor is becoming enormous. And the requirements of becoming middle class in this information technology services culture that we're moving into in the 21st century are tremendous. And people who cannot satisfy these requirements, you know, who are excluded from this group.
We're out of time. That's Jonathan Fast talking about his new book, Beyond Bullying, Breaking the Cycle of Shame, Bullying, and Violence.